Welcome to the Deep Dive, your shortcut to being truly well-informed. This is where we take a whole stack of compelling sources, academic papers, analyses, and really boil them down to the most important bits of knowledge and insight.
Yeah.
And hopefully we do it with, you know, just enough humor to keep you hooked.
Exactly. And today we're doing what we call the Security Nexus Deep Dive.
That's right.
And for anyone who might be new to us, the Security Nexus, well, we're a Maryland-based national security consultancy. Mm. Our focus is really on strategic advisory, education, and public engagement. We try to provide clear, accessible, and hopefully actionable insight into this really complex, evolving landscape of cyber threats, hybrid warfare, strategic security policy, the whole nine yards.
Yeah, through everything we put out, right? These deep dives, our blogs, training sessions, consulting.
Precisely. The core mission, it sounds simple, but it's vital. Just to inform, educate, and empower. Empower both professionals in the field and, frankly, the public with knowledge that actually matters in today's world.
And if you are looking for more resources or maybe want to connect with our work, see what else we're digging into, we definitely encourage you to visit thesecuritynexus.net.
Please do.
You'll find a ton of information there, always aimed at, you know, keeping you ahead of the curve on these complex topics. But for today's deep dive, we are literally looking up, way up, to space, the ultimate high ground.
It's such a fascinating topic, and honestly, it's becoming more critical by the day because space, well, it's not just about satellites beaming down weather pics for your morning forecast anymore or, you know, providing the GPS timing for your phone.
Not even close.
It's profoundly transformed. Almost while we weren't looking, it's become this contested, heavily surveilled battle space.
It really has. And our mission today for this deep dive is to unpack exactly how things like autonomous constellations, these on-orbit proximity operations satellites getting deliberately close to each other, and crucially, dual-use technologies.
Uh-huh. The cyber, the electronic warfare, even kinetic tools.
Exactly. How all that is profoundly reshaping, well, everything. Deterrence concepts, crisis stability, the actual pathways for escalation in conflicts down here on Earth.
It's about exploring those surprising and sometimes, frankly, unsettling connections, isn't it? Between technologies that seem perfectly benign on the surface and their potential for conflict.
Yeah, think about it. You have this AI system, right? Maybe it's designed brilliantly to manage space traffic, keep satellites from hitting each other in increasingly crowded orbits. Super important, peaceful stuff.
Absolutely vital, yeah.
But then, with maybe just a subtle tweak in its programming, that same AI could become a tool for precision targeting in a counterspace mission. The algorithms designed to prevent collisions could be flipped to orchestrate them.
Or, consider those cameras mapping crops from orbit. Totally innocent, right? Helping with agriculture.
Seems like it.
But with minor adjustments, maybe just refocusing or different software, they could become silent, persistent stalkers of another nation's satellites.
And then there's that domino effect. A seemingly small glitch, maybe a temporary malfunction in orbit. It could send a ripple, a shockwave, through our most sensitive systems. It could directly impact the timelines for nuclear command and control.
And these aren't just, you know, sci-fi what-ifs. These are the unsettling realities of dual-use technology. That line between peace and preparing for conflict, it's getting incredibly blurry up there.
So to help us untangle this really complex web, we're going to be drawing on insights from a fantastic collection of academic papers and analyses. Really great stuff.
Yeah, we're looking at foundational work by Jean-Sébastien Ardones and Gabriella Gaius from 2018. Sitki Agaili's really insightful analysis from 2021. Cutting-edge research by Enrico Lagona and his team from 2022.
Plus, Wersianik Masiski-Salima's crucial historical perspective from 2023. The contemporary analysis from Asma Rashid and Nivam Fatima in 2024.
Right, and also groundbreaking work by Kather von Thangavel and others also from 2024. And a really thought-provoking analysis coming up from Andrew Bickford due in 2025.
It's a great lineup. These experts give us crucial perspectives, past, present, and future, on space security. It helps build a really comprehensive picture of this domain.
Absolutely.
So to really get a grip on where we are today, I think we have to rewind, right? Go back to the beginning, or at least the beginning of modern space security, back to the Cold War.
Yeah, definitely. That era profoundly shaped how we see and use space now. It transformed it from what maybe seemed like a peaceful final frontier into just an indispensable strategic vantage point.
It was such a pivotal time and defined by this deep uncertainty, wasn't it? Before satellites really came online, the U.S. faced this huge, almost crippling, lack of credible intelligence on the Soviet Union.
It really did. And that scarcity of reliable info, well, it often led to a much higher perception of threat. You know, war zenik Mazieski Sulima, in his 2023 work, he really highlights this. It often resulted in these exaggerated estimates of Soviet military strength, their capabilities.
Which must have just fueled fear, right? Fear of aggression.
Exactly. Creating this potentially really destabilizing situation where miscalculation wasn't just like a possibility, it was a constant looming danger. The stakes were unbelievably high. Nuclear war was always, always in the background.
You can almost feel that pressure, that sense of flying blind, needing desperately to get a clearer picture of your adversary. So it's no surprise there was this intense push to find new ways to gather intelligence.
Right. And those early aerial reconnaissance flights, like the RB-47s in the 50s, flying along Soviet borders, they showed way more promise than trying to get spies on the ground inside that incredibly closed Soviet society.
So that naturally led to focusing upwards, that overhead perspective.
It did. This hunger for overhead perspective led directly to focusing on what could be achieved from above. And that focus, that technological drive, it culminated in the birth of the first real spy satellites, the most famous being the Korona program.
Korona.
Yeah. Resurrected in 58, right after Sputnik 1 shook everyone up, it became the very first operational reconnaissance satellite system. And Mazieski Sulima details this. It was incredibly ambitious for the time. I mean, imagine, it used this specialized panoramic camera.
Capturing huge swaths of territory from orbit.
Exactly. But the real engineering marvel was how they got the pictures back. A unique system to return the exposed film rolls to Earth in these little heat-shielded re-entry vehicles.
And this is the crazy part. They actually caught those film capsules mid-air with airplanes using hooks. I mean, that sounds like something out of a movie. Yeah. Was it as insane in practice?
Oh, completely. The success rate was initially very low. It highlighted the incredible technical hurdles they faced. And of course, to keep it all secret from the Soviets, the entire Korona program was brilliantly disguised.
Right. Under NASA's Civilian Discoverer Scientific Program label.
A masterclass in covert ops, doing vital intelligence gathering under the cover of peaceful science.
But even with the clever disguise, it wasn't an instant win, as you said. Those first, what, dozen Discoverer missions? Lots of failures, not reaching orbit, camera issues, burning up on reentry.
A tough start. But then, August 1960, the breakthrough. Discoverer 13. First successful recovery of anything man-made from space. It didn't have a camera, but it proved the system could work.
And then Discoverer 14, just a week later, actually brought back the pictures.
And the intelligence from that. It was absolutely unprecedented. It gave the U.S. reliable, objective data that fundamentally changed how they saw the Soviet threat. Critically, it showed the Soviet ICBM arsenal, their strategic bomber fleet. They were significantly smaller than the previous, often inflated, estimates.
That's huge. Not just interesting data, but something that directly impacted policy, right?
Directly. It limited the risk of miscalculation and maybe prevented a devastating preventive strike born out of fear or thinking you had to go first. This newfound, albeit covert, transparency helped stabilize a really precarious nuclear balance.
So while Korona was snapping pictures, giving that crucial insight into capabilities, there was another system being developed alongside it, MIDAS.
Right, MIDAS. Also developed by Lockheed, often launched under that same Discoverer cover story. But its mission was different. It was equipped with highly sensitive infrared sensors.
Designed to detect heat signatures.
Exactly. The distinctive heat surges from ICBM launches. The goal was early warning, providing those vital minutes against a potential surprise attack. Mazieski Sulima notes that MIDAS 7, launched in 63, became the first successful early warning satellite. It actually detected test launches of Polaris and Minuteman missiles.
That sounds like a game changer for security. Precious warning time. But you mentioned limitations earlier. What held it back and what came next?
Well, despite that success, MIDAS had several significant limitations. Firstly, the orbits, low Earth polar orbits. Great for coverage over time, but not constant global monitoring. There are gaps.
Okay.
Secondly, and this was critical, the infrared sensors, advanced as they were, sometimes mistook sunlight reflecting off clouds for missile launches.
Oh, wow. False alarms.
Exactly. Imagine the tension, the potential panic in a command center during the Cold War from a false alarm. That added a huge layer of uncertainty. So these issues, especially false positives, led to it being discontinued by 1966.
But the need for space-based early warning was clearly established.
Absolutely. The strategic benefit was obvious. So MIDAS was replaced by the much more advanced defense support program, DSP, in 1970. DSP significantly improved on Midas's capabilities, and, well, its successors are still providing early warning today.
What's really fascinating looking back is how the Soviet civilian space program itself, Sputnik, especially in 57, kind of accidentally laid the groundwork for this crucial legal idea, freedom of space.
It's a great paradox, isn't it? The Soviets were showing off technological might, but they also normalized satellites being up there. Now, initially, the USSR protested reconnaissance overflights, saw them as sovereignty violations like the U-2 spy plane incidents.
Right.
But their protests pretty much stopped when they launched their own reconnaissance satellite, Zenit 2, in 1963. Mitschdisky Sulima explains, Zenit 2 basically mirrored Corona's mission photographic intelligence of U.S. installations. Hard to complain about something you're also doing.
So by the mid-60s, you have both Corona and Zenit fully operational. Both superpowers getting crucial intel on each other. This mutual transparency, this orbital spying, it really did become a weird, uneasy pillar of mutually assured destruction, MAMAD. It made a surprise first strike almost impossible.
Precisely. This system of, you could call it, covert, legal, and mutual invigilation, it was reinforced by the UN satellite registry set up in 1962. That made all launches public, even if you could hide the satellite's true purpose.
So everyone knew something was launched, even if not what exactly.
Right. Governments were notified, but they could save face internationally by not acknowledging the spying. But the key impact. Knowing your opponent had satellites meant you knew they'd see any big threatening move, they could react. Surprise nuclear strikes, effectively rendered obsolete, a profound impact on stability that, you know, still echoes today.
Okay, so the Cold War definitely forged space into a strategic arena, changing ideas about transparency and deterrence. But that was largely a two-player game. Things look very different now, don't they? It's way more crowded, way more competitive up there.
Oh, absolutely. It's a completely different landscape. Yeah. As Rashid and Fatima describe in their 2024 work, space is unequivocally a new dimension of warfare now. We've moved far beyond that simpler U.S.-Russia duopoly. China's dramatic entry into the space arms race, especially with its pretty impressive anti-satellite or ISS program, has thrown entirely new and complex dynamics into the mix. It fundamentally challenges that old dominance.
That term, great game of space, really seems to fit, doesn't it? Captures the escalating arms race, the political maneuvering. It suggests warfare could actually start in space now, maybe without any explosions on the ground, maybe without us even seeing it clearly from Earth.
It's an invisible battlefield in many ways, but the stakes for security, the economy, even just daily life relying on satellites, they're incredibly high. And it's not just a catchy phrase, it's reality. The U.S., China, Russia, they're pouring massive resources into space budgets, actively competing for power in those critical orbits.
And creating dedicated military branches just for space, too.
Exactly. The U.S. established the Space Force. China launched the People's Liberation Army Strategic Support Force, the SSF, back in 2015. That was a huge move, specifically designed to protect their satellites, monitor rivals, and provide retaliatory capabilities. And crucially, the SSF integrates cyber and electronic warfare directly with its space missions. That highlights the increasingly blurred lines, the dual-use nature of these capabilities. A cyber attack can disable a satellite just as effectively as a missile.
And the capabilities themselves are evolving so fast. Rashid and Fatima detail this expanding arsenal, moving way beyond just blowing things up kinetically.
Yeah, the toolbox is getting incredibly diverse and, frankly, sophisticated. You've got ASATs, anti-satellite weapons designed to neutralize or destroy satellites. These can be launched from space itself, from the ground, even from the sea.
Different kinds, right? Direct descent, co-orbital.
Right. Direct descent ASATs are missiles launched straight up. Co-orbital ASATs are basically other satellites that maneuver close to disable or destroy a target. Then you have space strike weapons, could be powerful lasers, ground-based or space-based, designed to blind or damage sensitive optics, or kinetic tools for direct impact.
Plus missile defense systems, hypersonic capabilities. It all adds layers.
It does, and it blurs the line between offense and defense. These aren't just theoretical concepts. They're being actively developed, tested. It makes the whole orbital environment feel much more fragile.
And here's where it gets maybe even more unsettling. It's not always about outright destruction anymore, is it? There's this more insidious interference. Sipke Egeli, in his 2021 analysis, he really emphasizes how harassing or destroying satellites can be done just by putting another satellite nearby and maneuvering it really close.
He calls them co-orbital anti-satellite operations, co-ASATs. And what's particularly worrying is the idea of space mines.
Space mines?
Yeah, interceptors that can change orbit to approach a target satellite. maybe immediately or maybe after staying dormant, undetected, just lying in wait for a while. Igaly gives this stark example. A Soviet COESA interceptor operational way back in 1973. It was designed to get close using radar, then detonate an explosive charge, hitting the target with shrapnel.
That early, wow.
Yeah. It shows a long-standing intent, and it makes it incredibly hard to tell the difference between a benign inspection maneuver, maybe checking on your own satellite, and the prelude to an attack. The ambiguity is dangerous.
And alongside these physical threats, the surveillance game is just escalating like crazy. China and Russia targeting objects in distant orbits. Rashid and Fatima mentioned China strategically placing ground stations closer to U.S. space forces, even operating their own satellites super close, sometimes just kilometers away from U.S. geostationary assets.
Indeed. Espionage tactics are incredibly sophisticated now. It's not just military intel. It's decoding info from rival satellites for, say, political propaganda, trying to exploit secrets or perceived weaknesses.
And direct hijacking or destruction just to steal data.
States have developed weapons for that, too. Russia's Cosmos 2499 in 2014, the one nicknamed Kamikaze by some analysts, its weird maneuver suggested testing capabilities to inspect, maybe tamper with, maybe disable other satellites. And, you know, similar tactics are attributed implicitly or explicitly to China and the U.S. as well.
Mm-hmm.
Where's the line between legitimate surveillance and aggressive interference? It's getting very blurry.
Plus, all those tiny nano and micro satellites just make everything harder to track, right?
Yeah.
More eyes in the sky, harder to see.
Exactly. They exacerbate the surveillance concerns because they're so hard to detect due to their tiny size. It clouds the picture of what's really happening up there.
And then there's another layer, electromagnetic warfare.
Right. Rashid and Fatima highlight this too. Satellites using powerful electromagnetic radiation to jam communications. Not just ground-to-satellite links for the owner, but potentially jamming the links of other nations' satellites.
Disrupting command and control, navigation, intel streams.
Precisely. A tactic routinely employed by the major players US, China, Russia, designed to render an adversary's space assets useless without physically destroying anything. Silent disruption.
And the awful side effect of all this competition and testing, space debris.
Yeah, the unintended but equally dangerous consequence. China's 2007 ASAT test, the one where they deliberately destroyed their own old weather satellite, Fengjin 1C, it created something like 6,000 new pieces of trackable debris. Instantly.
That's not just a warning about future conflict potential. It's a huge long-term hazard right now.
It
threatens all satellites.
Including their own. It just increases the collision probability for everyone, potentially leading to more debris in this terrifying chain reaction scenario, the Kessler syndrome.
So the space environment isn't just getting crowded and contested. It's getting polluted with the garbage from past actions.
Exactly. These fragments, moving at incredible speeds, they're weapons in themselves, capable of crippling active satellites, making future operations way more dangerous. It's like a self-inflicted wound on the orbital commons.
Which leads us perfectly into maybe the most revolutionary element changing this landscape. Artificial intelligence and autonomous systems. This feels like a true game changer, promising amazing things, but also raising huge new security questions.
Absolutely. It's transforming things. Lagona and his colleagues in their 2022 research, they introduced this term SmartSats, a new class of space platforms. What makes them different is the onboard AI. They leverage the Internet of Things, IoT paradigm, but in space.
So satellites talking to each other, processing data themselves, not just relaying to Earth.
Exactly. They're becoming interconnected, intelligent nodes in this vast distributed network, capable of communicating, processing data independently without constant human handholding from the ground. They're designed for much higher levels of autonomy, enabling really responsive, resilient operations. And this is driven by needs across the board, commercial, scientific, and critically, defense.
It's a real revolution. And
yeah.
Tied into this is the idea of distributed satellite systems, DSS.
Right. Thangavel and his co-authors explain this well in their 2024 paper. DSS means multiple spacecraft, often smaller ones, working together cooperatively to achieve common goals. It's a big shift away from those traditional monolithic, huge, expensive satellites.
Towards more flexible setups,
yeah.
Like constellations?
Yeah, constellations with many small sats.
Oh.
Or fractionated systems, splitting functions across modules, federated systems integrating different satellite types, modular systems you can upgrade in orbit, even swarms where tiny satellites act almost like one organism.
What are the big advantages driving this shift?
Well, several compelling ones. First, cost-effectiveness. It leverages that low size, weight, power, and cost swapsy of small satellite tech. Instead of $1 billion bird, you have dozens, maybe hundreds, of cheaper units.
Built-in redundancy, too.
Big time. Mission risk goes way down. Losing one or even a few modules doesn't necessarily kill the whole system. And it allows for a flexible, progressive deployment, launch a basic set, then add capability or replace units incrementally, build out your architecture over time.
And these DSS aren't just theory. They're being looked at for critical jobs like space-based space surveillance, SBSS.
Definitely. For continuous detection, tracking, monitoring of all those resonance based objects, RSOs, active sats, dead sats, debris in both low Earth orbit, LEO, which is super crowded, and geosynchronous orbit, GSO, which is critical for comms and intel. Lagona et al. Point out these systems can often spot smaller objects invisible from the ground. Unprecedented situational awareness, really enhancing space traffic management.
So how does AI actually elevate this autonomy, make it smarter?
The ultimate goal is moving away from that traditional ground control model, where every tiny maneuver needs human input from Earth. We're moving towards much higher levels of onboard autonomy. This includes what the European Space Agency calls goal-oriented systems, the highest level of spacecraft autonomy.
Meaning the satellite decides how to achieve a goal.
Pretty much. Sophisticated AI allows satellites to autonomously figure out the best course of action based on high-level, user-defined goals, making intelligent decisions in real time without constant human oversight.
So AI isn't just a nice add-on. It's becoming critical for handling the complexity.
Absolutely critical. Fangovel et al. Highlight tons of applications, like satellite trajectory planning and collision avoidance. AI can rapidly spot collision risks and then, importantly, implement the optimal maneuver with the precision humans just couldn't match in real time.
Is there a specific example of how that works?
Yeah, Lagona et al. Demonstrate using particle swarm optimization, PSO. It's a meta-heuristic AI algorithm. Think of it like a swarm of digital bees working together, learning from each other to find the absolute best solution to a complex problem. Like avoiding a collision.
So the satellite itself figures out the best dodge.
Right. It can rapidly generate incredibly precise maneuvers, like shifting its orbit by just, say, 1.68 kilometers. Seems tiny, right? But it can drastically cut the collision probability down to almost nothing, like 1 in 100,000. That kind of precision, that real-time decision-making on board, it's crucial not just for safety, but also for things like pointing sensitive instruments correctly, avoiding bright objects like the sun or Earth.
And the AI applications go beyond just driving, right?
Yeah.
Health monitoring.
Oh, yeah. Intelligent Health and Mission Management, IHMM. AI constantly monitoring all the satellite subsystems, providing advanced diagnosis, even prognosis predicting potential failures before they happen, and reacting automatically, reconfiguring resources to mitigate problems. This drastically cuts down the need for human intervention for routine stuff or even emergencies, frees up ground crews.
Communications too, managing signals.
Definitely. AI can manage power, frequencies, overcome interference, whether it's natural or deliberate jamming, optimized data transmission back to Earth, or between satellites and a network, vital for keeping links robust.
And processing data on board.
Huge for remote sensing. Instead of sending massive amounts of raw data down, which takes bandwidth and time, AI on the satellite can intelligently process it, identify what's important, and just send back the key insights. Makes real-time intelligence much more feasible.
But it can't all be smooth sailing. There must be challenges, hurdles to overcome with all this autonomy.
Oh, absolutely. Significant hurdles. Fangovel et al. Talk about the challenges for trusted autonomous satellite operations, or TAS. You've got the technical stuff first. Ensuring AI systems react fast enough, adapt to the unexpected, coordinate flawlessly in these complex distributed systems.
And the black box problem.
That's a big one. With deep learning models, it's often hard to know why the AI made a specific decision. That makes trust and debugging really difficult. Plus, getting enough good data to train these models, avoiding bias in the data, making sure the learning works across different missions, major technical headaches.
And then there are the ethical and legal issues, which sound even trickier.
They might be. What happens if an autonomous satellite messes up, causes damage? Who's liable? How do you navigate AI ethics, ensure these systems actually align with human values and intent? How do you build public trust in machines making potentially critical decisions?
The whole new legal and ethical frontier.
It really is.
Yeah.
And engineering itself is shifting from deterministic design, where you know exactly what will happen, to non-deterministic, where AI introduces unpredictability. That needs entirely new ways to certify these systems, new regulations, frameworks that frankly, don't really exist yet. Huge roadblocks before TASO is fully and safely integrated.
Okay, let's shift gears slightly to something maybe more abstract but just as potent. The psychological side. Projecting power, intent, through symbols. Even on something like a mission patch for a spy satellite.
Yeah, Andrew Bickford's 2025 analysis is fascinating here. He looks anthropologically at the NRL-39 mission patch. This was a U.S. spy satellite launched back in 2013 by the National Reconnaissance Office, the NRO.
And the patch itself is pretty memorable.
Understatement. It prominently features this huge, angry-looking octopus. Its tentacles are wrapped tightly around the entire globe. And then there's the motto, "Nothing is beyond our reach."
Wow. Subtle.
Not exactly. And remember, the NRO is the agency running U.S. spy satellites, gathering intel from space. Their official motto is usually supra et ultra, above and beyond. This patch, Bickford argues compellingly, wasn't just some random design choice. It was a very deliberate, a very potent political and symbolic act.
Deliberate is the key word. Bickford argues using the octopus isn't just a mascot thing. Historically, octopuses, giant squids, they often symbolize evil, danger, creeping domination, the monstrous unknown from the depths. You see it in protest imagery, in pop culture.
Right. But here's the twist, the inversion. The NRO takes that symbol, traditionally used against power, and flips it. It becomes a direct statement of state power, of dominance. Bickford calls this aspirational biomimetics, which I think is a brilliant phrase.
Aspirational biomimetics. Explain that a bit more.
It means the NRO is projecting the capabilities they want their technology to have onto it, using this biological metaphor. Like cephalopods, octopuses, squids with their huge eyes, their ensnaring tentacles. The satellites are imagined to see everything, to encircle the globe with sensors, to devour electronic signals and intelligence.
So it's not just internal morale, it's meant to intimidate.
Absolutely. The symbol is intended to terrify, to intimidate potential enemies, to signal overwhelming U.S. tech superiority and global reach. It deliberately blurs that line between providing security and projecting insecurity onto others.
And Bickford found something else, right? A note.
Yeah, this is striking. A handwritten note by an NRO official right next to the mission motto on some document apparently just said, "A little sinister."
A little sinister.
And Bickford's take is that this wasn't a note of concern. It was likely a positive affirmation. Like, good, it is intimidating. That's the point. It underscores this militarized mindset, willing to publicly embrace a symbol usually associated with oppression and terror and wear it like a badge of honor.
So it's basically psychological warfare, using fear.
Bickford views it that way, intentionally exploiting those deep-seated fears, deep ocean, deep space, government surveillance to assert dominance and capability, a powerful, if yeah, profoundly unnerving message.
Okay, moving from those psychological projections back to very practical existential worries. Let's talk strategic stability, the future of space security. One of the scariest things is the direct link between orbit and nuclear command, control, and communications, NC3.
Absolutely terrifyingly direct. The reality is a seemingly minor glitch or a deliberate attack way up in orbit. It can ripple straight into nuclear C3 timelines. It could potentially escalate a conventional fight into something unimaginable.
Yeah, so what's the mechanism?
Siki Ajeli, in his 2021 work, really emphasizes this. Those positioning, navigation, and timing signals, PNT, broadcast constantly by satellites in medium Earth orbit, MEO, they've become absolutely critical for modern NC3.
GPS signals, basically, but for military systems.
Essentially, yes, but highly precise and secured. These signals enable secure comms, data links, sensor fusion, network operations, basically everything for modern military functions. Without those space-based signals, operations, especially involving nuclear assets, could just grind to a dangerous halt.
And we don't have easy backups on the ground for that.
Ajeli highlights this, relying solely on terrestrial backups for such critical, time-sensitive functions. Generally impractical, maybe impossible on the scale needed, it just underscores how indispensable space assets have become, which makes them incredibly tempting, but also incredibly dangerous targets. We've built a real vulnerability there.
Which leads to this idea of entanglement that Ajeli talks about.
Exactly, a perilous scenario. Imagine a non-nuclear fight starts, maybe a regional conflict, and one or both sides, who happen to be nuclear armed, decide to target each other's satellites. Maybe the initial goal is just to mess up conventional war efforts, gain a tactical edge. But the critical danger is that most, if not all, military satellites now have dual purposes. They support conventional forces targeting intel, and they support nuclear forces, including those vital NC3 systems. There aren't really strategic satellites dedicated only to NC3 anymore that are clearly separate.
So you hit a satellite thinking you're just hurting their conventional capability.
But the owner might see it as an attack on their nuclear deterrent, on their ability to command and control nuclear forces. Even if that wasn't the intent, targeting these high-value, dual-use satellites could make the owner feel incredibly alarmed, misinterpret the attack.
And potentially cross the nuclear threshold, an invisible slippery slope in the fog of war.
It really is. Edgley notes, for instance, the U.S. has explicitly threatened nuclear use if its NC3 is attacked, even with non-nuclear weapons. Russia has its escalate-to-de-escalate doctrine, potentially using tactical nukes. Even China's official no-first-use policy might have caveats if strategic, dual-use targets like space assets are hit hard conventionally. The ambiguity in space directly fuels nuclear escalation risks on Earth. It's deeply unsettling.
And it feels like the legal framework, international law, just hasn't kept up with any of this. We're operating in a legal gray zone. Maybe even a vacuum.
That feels absolutely right. Despite decades of effort, the Outer Space Treaty back in 67, which bans WMDs in orbit, various multilateral initiatives, the major powers just keep expanding and modernizing their space arsenals.
Treaty limitations aren't working.
Rashid and Fatima point this out starkly. China, Russia, the U.S., they haven't signed or ratified key treaties aimed specifically at limiting space weapons. It shows a fundamental weakness, the ineffectiveness of existing international institutions here. The space arms race just keeps escalating, basically unchecked. Space is morphing from that hopeful realm of peaceful exploration into one dominated by aggressive political agendas, and let's not forget, all that dangerous debris.
So given this incredibly complex, dangerous picture, what's the path forward? How do policymakers, how do we navigate this?
It's an urgent task. Policymakers desperately need to focus on building redundancy into systems, improving attribution capabilities, and establishing clear norms for orbital operations.
Break those down. Redundancy.
Having backups. Distributed networks. So losing one satellite doesn't cripple critical functions, makes the whole system less vulnerable, less tempting to attack.
Attribution. Knowing who did what.
Crucial. Being able to clearly identify who's responsible for an aggressive act in space. Vital for preventing miscalculation, for avoiding unintended escalation based on wrong assumptions.
And norms.
Rules of the road.
Agreed upon rules of behavior. What's acceptable, what's not, in orbit. We need this urgently, before ambiguity becomes the spark for unintended conflict. Before a misunderstanding or an attack, you can't identify spirals out of control.
So a big shift in focus is needed towards finding common ground.
Absolutely. Resolving the space security conflict proactively. Maybe revising that outdated legal framework. Mm-hmm. And importantly, this isn't just for governments. The public needs to be aware of what's happening up there, the implications, because the consequences for daily life, for global stability, are huge. Absolutely. Well, on that incredibly important point, we've covered a lot of ground today. We journeyed from the Cold War roots of space surveillance through this really complex, modern, great game with all its traditional and non-traditional threats.
To the revolutionary but also really challenging integration of AI and autonomous systems.
And even touched on that fascinating, unsettling psychological side, projecting power through symbols like that octopus.
And what really stands out, woven through it all, is that pervasive dual-use nature of the technology, isn't it?
It really is. The same AI that carefully optimizes space traffic to avoid collisions could, with a slight change, cue a counterspace attack. Mm. The same cameras mapping crops for peaceful use could silently stalk another nation's satellites.
And that small glitch in orbit, that unannounced close approach, it could have these profound cascading effects right into nuclear command and control timelines, pushing us towards thresholds we really, really don't want to cross.
So, as we keep pushing the technological boundaries in space, here's a final provocative thought for you, our listeners, to ponder. In this domain where that line between peace and conflict is getting so incredibly blurred by dual-use tech and these militarized symbols, can global powers ever truly achieve shared security? Or are we just destined for a perpetual great game among the stars?
And maybe even more importantly, what responsibility do we as informed citizens actually have in trying to shape the norms, the rules for this new and, frankly, increasingly dangerous frontier?
Definitely something to think about.
Until next time, keep exploring, keep questioning, and stay informed.
Thank you for joining us on The Deep Dive.